You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weiner-Kent. I'm here with...
Senior Editor Susie Evans.
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
And we just yesterday got in the office our first copies of the September issue. The last one that Jim's in the office for, our previous editor, and it's a beauty. It's got a little show you might have heard of called Hamilton on the cover, an exclusive photo, Lin-Manuel Miranda and his cast, and the interview, as we teased on last week's podcast, because it was on, it's already online, that Susie did with Lin-Manuel's in there. I'll just note briefly that my other favorite thing in this is the blood photo. We were able to run a quick explanation of that. Rajiv Joseph's beautiful play, Guards at the Taj, is our play, the script this month. And spoiler, folks who haven't seen it yet, the second scene takes place. It's a funny and interesting play.
Really, is it really a spoiler if the play is in the
magazine? It's a spoiler to the people listening. It's a spoiler to people listening deep who have not seen the play. And this is, which is why we published the photo. The second scene is in a room of blood. We'll just say that. These photos were not released. You can't find them on the website. You probably can't find these photos anywhere on the web until today, since we published the Rajiv interview. They didn't want to release photos of the blood room because it was a spoiler, and a sort of a shocking reveal when you're in the theater with it. The play is going to open in the Geffen Playhouse in a couple months, and then Woolly Mammoth in February. So, sorry for the spoiler alert. They did talk about how Amy Morton, the director, insisted on more blood. I think Rajiv was willing to go with a little less, and she said no more. So maybe there are two different directors, two totally different productions coming up, and maybe the directors will go for more, for a romper room full of blood, or just a little trickle. Who knows?
I feel like that's a listicle or a photo gallery.
That's a photo gallery waiting to happen.
Or maybe just talk to the actors and
about blood.
Because that second scene, they're cleaning it up as they're talking.
Yeah, it's a real time cleanup.
They're not just actors; they're also the cleanup crew.
Exactly. For like drainage set design and make sure there's places for the blood to drain out.
Yeah, I'm trying to think the Geffen space. I don't know I know the Woolly Mammoth space. You'll be above it, looking down at the blood.
The Geffen space is a little bit raked like this.
A little bit. Yeah.
Well, the thing about the way they did it at the Atlantic was they didn't even fill up the entire Atlantic stage. It was a box
within,
with a wall, stone wall over it, and then you think these two guys are going to be talking from the stone wall for 90 minutes, and then
you knew there would be a reveal or something. Come on, something behind there.
The Maximum podcast told me there would be a reveal, so they spoiled it for me.
Okay.
Which is completely fine. I spoil things for myself all the time. But it's been a very bloody year. I've seen quite a number of shows that
The Times did that article last year. Was it about stage blood with
Tamerlane?
Yeah, there's lots of blood there.
Yeah, that one was just spraying everywhere. And I went to see Zombie, the Americans, by Robert O'Hara, William Mammoth. That thing had a lot less blood than I thought it would. For sure about zombies, it was... There were no pools of blood.
Hmm.
So I think Rajiv's the only play I've seen an actual pool of blood.
Actual pools?
A pool of blood requires a very specific plot point.
Exactly.
Well, 50,000 hands.
Yeah.
Well, now you're spoiling the whole play.
Am I really spoiling the whole play when they present that concept in the first 30 minutes of the play?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm trying to remember if any of the New York reviews revealed it. Let's just say that we give it a warm hand. Guards at the Taj. A warm hand on my entrance, as Hedwig would say. Anyway.
Susie's just shaking her head.
Yes. So that's a September issue.
I don't like blood.
September issue. I don't love blood either. In fact, I will say the one thing this reminded me of the most was at the same space at the Atlantic several years ago, a play I just really did not like because of the blood was Lieutenant of Inishmore, which has a scene break. And they play loud music so you can't tell what's going on stage, and it opens, and people have already been, heads have been blown off already, but you're like, okay, that was a bit much, but the scene goes black and it comes up. Do you know this play? And they're like sawing up the bodies that they just killed, and they're just, and you know, the joke is like, we're just talking, telling jokes while we're sawing up. Like, no, that's not that funny to me. Anyway, it's also a bit like the reveal in Hand of God when you see what happens in the basement. Like, whoa. So, you know, those reveal moments, maybe a piece about that. Reveal moments that are shocking, like they completely
like
fucked up the set
between
them.
That's an interesting one from a set designer perspective.
But then how do we even get the photos for that? Because most of the time the theater is
go to the photographer.
Releasing it.
We would have to insist we're American theater. We get what we want.
anyway, that was a long discussion about blood.
Blood. I didn't mean to go there. It's September 15th. The show is not all about blood. It's about fun other things too. The first part of Todd London's update of actors who graduated 20 years ago from Yale School of Drama is in there, and the next part's in our October issue. Let's update on a few things that seem to be perennial themes on our podcast. One, last week we talked about, I had come back from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and saw Lynn Nottage's new play Sweat, and I did not see Jeff Woody's new Go-Go's musical because of fires in the nearby hills. But one of the concerns that was that we spoke about last week was the fact that New York critics, including New York Times' Charles Isherwood and Wall Street Journal's Terry Teachout, would be in town to review these plays. And we had a spirited discussion about one of Tim Sanford's favorite topics and many people's bugaboos, the Times sending critics out to cover plays in resident theaters before they come to New York. And I know I can speak, I don't think it's speaking out of turn, I'm doing a lot of reporting about the festival, that Lynn Nottage and her director, Kate Wariski, were concerned about having reviews of a play that only got three previews, which is a lot less than it would get in New York. The Head Over Heels team also had its concerns as well. Charles Isherwood's review of Sweat, which finally came out, is among the best, the strongest raves I've ever seen him do. And his Head Over Heels one was mostly laudatory. I don't think he likes the Go-Go's very much. I think it still raises the question of now, of course, because he liked them, it's like, well, everything's okay then, right? I don't know. I still...
When's it coming to New York?
Sweat? Well, now it's definitely... Now it's,
yeah,
now
it's happening.
Now it's not only coming to New York. I wouldn't be surprised if people start talking about Broadway, you know. But it's going to Arena Stage in the spring. If we're talking about Sweat, I don't know about Head Over Heels. Again, I think the discussion is still worth having because Charles Isherwood doesn't just give bad reviews when he goes out of town. He gives, rave reviews and laudatory reviews and reviews that raise expectations. I still sort of stand by my idea that folks like Charles McNulty, Chris Jones, Peter Marks, who are in non-New York markets but see plays that have New York intentions, I think they approach their reviews differently and to give a more sort of provisional review, knowing that it's a provisional production. On the other hand, if Charles was sincerely, I don't question his if he really sincerely felt like this is one of the best things I've ever seen and it should be on stage right away, who's going to hold him back from that, right?
Yeah, but then the opposite way would be, this is a horrible play, you should not be producing this.
I guess my point is, how do you get the critic to reframe the way he's writing about it. It's like, it's never a problem, I guess, when it's praise, except I would argue that praise raises expectations. I mean, this play, I know for a fact that some of those company members are cast in productions next year at OSF, I believe. And his review for that entire production was so strong. It seems like the whole production, like basically just cart it fully, just put it on a truck and drive it to New York now is kind of like the way. And, you know, I think giving some idea of the context under which it was created or I don't know. I guess I'm just trying to say good or bad reviews, the issue is still whether it's a great idea to have the Times or any critic of that kind of power come in from on high and render either their laurels or their...
Well, I mean, to be fair, like, I was glad Charles reviewed it because that's who I read, and I read the New York Times, and I wanted to know about Sweat, and so there it was for me. I'm not going to go seek out the Oregon review of Sweat. I feel like
no, of course not. No, I know. I would just... That's the update on that. I don't know how I'm going to... It certainly is an issue when any resident theater, original theater, is wanting to make itself a player on the new play scene. Right. So it's a concern that's not going to go away. Another concern that is not going
to
go away.
Well, what story are you working on, just to give?
Oh, a giant feature on Oregon Shakespeare Festival and Bill Rausch's leadership of said festival, and the changes he has wrought.
Yeah. Upcoming in our October issue.
Exactly. Another issue that's not going away, I was going to say, and that another of us is reporting on, is gender disparity and how there's, you know, a persistent disparity between male and female playwrights produced in our theaters. The number holds pretty firmly around 20% versus 80% women to men authors, women to male authors. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're reporting on that, Susie?
Yeah. I'm writing a story for October issue, which is kind of themed around this topic, gender disparity, about theaters across the country who either have a really good track record of parity in their seasons or doing it really well in their 2015-2016 season. So I've been calling, I think I'm talking to about 15-ish theaters who are across the country who are doing it well. And also as part of that reporting, I, along with the rest of the AT staff, has been going through the member seasons and counting them, kind of based on the same metrics of the Dramatists Guild and the Lily Awards, the count. We're going through just the 2015-2016 season. And in addition to just counting women versus male playwrights, I've been counting which seasons who are TCG members have parity. There's about 500 TCG members, and I haven't counted every single theater yet. I probably counted about, what would you say, deep 300? 250?
250.
About 250 so far, and out of those 250, about 40, 45 have parity, and that just means 50% of their plays, not even
full seasons. At least 50%, right.
Yeah. And so that's kind of an interesting statistic to look at how many people have parity. That doesn't mean that the theaters that don't have parity aren't producing women. There's probably one, maybe two women in their season, but looking at which ones have parity.
Well, of course, you could argue they don't have parity if they're all female, but it's not parity. But they're saying it's 50% or more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people I've talked to for this article have said that doing a season of all women is not parity. It might be parity over time, but if you're just tokenizing the feminine experience to market it for one season.
Well, it's also just strictly speaking, math-wise, not parity because it's not half and half. But it's just a drop in the bucket of a whole, of an industry, you know. Unless a theater was set, unless the theater started out as a female only or female focused, if every theater in the country did an all female season next season, that would only move the numbers over the aggregate a little bit. Yeah. Right?
I mean, the two most interesting conversations I've had so far out of the people I've talked to were one with Lisa McNulty at the Women's Project, who said that she's really frustrated by not being included in the parity conversation a lot just because she's a female identity-focused theater.
Oh, right, right.
And so people don't come to ask her about parity because they just assume that that's what she's going to do. And so she was really passionate about, you know, they launched Tanya Barfield's play Bright Half-Life, which is getting a production at the Magic Theater, which also has a season of all women next year because the artistic director, Laura Radigratko, used to run the Women's Project. But it's also going to have a production at Profile Theater in Seattle,
which
is doing
all
a whole
Tanya.
Season of Tanya. And I think there's a few more of it, and it got launched at a women's theater. And so, you know, there's a conceived notion of what a women's play is at a women's theater. And Lisa's really critical of that. She wants to make sure that they're just doing good work. I mean, they did a play last season by Laura Eason that was centered really on a man, and it was a guy's play, but it happened to be written by Laura Eason, who, you know, writes for House of Cards, which is a huge,
Which play was that?
I forget what it was called. It was at Rattlesick. It was a co-production in
Rattlesick. It was a father-daughter play. The Undeniable Sound of Right Now.
There you go.
Not a bad show.
And then the other conversation that I had that was really interesting was just today with PJ Powers at Timeline Theater in Chicago. And he had actually done his own counting of his own season and admitted that he hadn't had a very good parity track record. And he kind of had been doing a pretty poor job and not paying attention to it. But in the last 5 years that there's kind of been more attention to it, he and his staff and his company, because they all select plays together, had paid more attention to it. And so he went from having his track record over the theater's 18-year history being 20% female playwrights, the last 4 years being 56% female playwrights.
Right.
So he was like, I did something. He was like, we weren't doing it right, and so we made a change. And it wasn't that hard to make that change.
Yeah, I just think people being conscious of it is the first step.
I think people have a hard time admitting that they weren't doing it right, which is why I think it was really interesting that PJ Powers was like, no, we weren't doing it right.
Right.
A lot of people don't like to admit, you know,
that they're being discriminatory.
They like to say we're just doing the best plays. And I don't think you would use the word discriminatory, but they just weren't paying attention in the way they should have been paying attention.
Sure. Well, it's going from unconscious of the biases that you bring to it to being sort of more conscious that is a bias.
Yeah, and they come from a really interesting mission in that their plays focused around history. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, so many historical narratives are about, you know, middle-aged white guys in positions of power, so they have to be conscious of what stories of history they're telling.
Right, right. Well, of course, the issue of not just who's writing it, but what's on stage is important. Yeah. Well, the big gender disparity parody news this week was Manhattan Theater Club, which has been putting together a season of entirely male white plays, or sorry, male
plays
white playwrights,
white men.
And only one female director, Lynn Meadow, who is going to direct the, I think, the Richard Greenberg play.
Who's also the artistic director of the theater.
Right. So this generated a lot of controversy, not least because MTC, as I think I've mentioned on this very podcast, I didn't stress the diversity of their programming, but I've admired the way among all the Broadway nonprofits, they have, you know, the best record of producing living American playwrights in their Broadway space. Roundabout and LCT, as we've said before, do a great job developing talent in their off-Broadway spaces. But MTC also has had a better record than many in terms of somewhat on ethnic diversity, but especially on gender parity. Their last season, in fact, was exactly 50-50. The previous year was something like closer to 20%. Before that, it was close to parity. They've had a better record than most. So it was especially galling to many when they announced that their season was going to be all male playwrights. What became clear, there was outcry, and the Times reported they were planning a play by a woman, Penelope Skinner play.
A British woman, yes.
Village Bike playwright, a new play called Ruins of Civilization. They were planning it, and they sort of rushed ahead to announce it, and they tentatively said Lila Neugebauer was going to direct it.
Yeah, well, they never officially announced their season. They just had the most of it up on their website, so we wrote a post about
it.
Yeah, it was more like they announced it
piecemeal.
Like over a span
and,
of
you know,
months.
And, as many people pointed out, it's an interesting and artistically credible season. Like, there's great, interesting new plays on it by writers, all of them respectable. Nick Payne, Nick Jones, Shanley, Greenberg.
All of them that they produced before, too.
David Lindsay Abaire. A fair amount of them. They've never done Nick Jones, I don't think.
Constellations, right?
No, Payne.
Nick Payne.
Oh, my apologies, Nick
I mean,
Jones.
Yeah, certainly it's not all. But, you know, these are people, all of whose plays I would like to see, including Shanley's.
You don't need to see them in the same season, though.
From the same theater.
Yeah.
I think the point that was made also in the Times article by a member of the Kilroys, Zakiya Alexander, she said that all of these men, like you say, are all respected, are good artistic voices that we want to see. And it's not their fault that they all got plopped into the same season.
But then it also goes back to the unconscious bias thing. And Lynn, the funny thing about the article was they specifically said that Lynn Meadow cut her vacation short to talk to the Times about this issue because of the 48-hour outcry over that season. Mm-hmm. And she said that she wasn't even aware that this was happening. Like, it was just how it turned out. When artistic directors program non-diverse, non-gender parity season, that's the go-to excuse. We didn't realize that we were doing this. Hmm. And so how many times can we hear the excuse of, I didn't mean to be racist or sexist. I just programmed the best plays that came to my desk, which
I mean,
it's almost saying like women and people of color don't write good plays.
I think without singling out this one theater, there's a larger systemic problem, as we've seen. Everyman Theater in Baltimore, Firehouse Theater in Richmond, Virginia,
Northlight
Theater in Chicago. There's a number that have come
City
to
Theater
in Long Beach. Yeah, that have programmed all men. I think if you look at theaters deserve some context to look at their, which is why I think it's important to say MTC has been better than most. So that it's not just, but they do need to know that as a PR matter, more than just a PR matter, especially when you're a large nonprofit in New York, where you're going to be so influential about what plays are going to be produced in the future, that the season is a menu and it is a statement, and it's just like your budget, where you spend your money. It's important. You might, and I don't empathize or I don't envy the sort of seven-dimensional chess that it must be to pull together a season. The rights, you know, again, this is not exculpatory, but it's like it is complicated to put together a season, but you know, or to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which we've talked about, that's a classical theater with Shakespeare in its name. They have to do at least three or four or more Shakespeares. That knocks out five of their 11 slots are going to be by a dead white man. They do better than a lot of other theaters on diversity and parity, gender parity, because Bill Rausch has made it a priority. And he does what a lot of theaters that are classically oriented do, which I think is a strong choice, was to hire as many female directors.
Yeah, I think classical theater, designers. You gotta put your view on parity to other realms.
But they also, I mean, you know, the most produced living playwrights there are Lynn Nottage and Robert Schenken. So,
no, they do a great job of playwrights too. But
yeah, because I was looking at our most produced playlist from the past couple of years, and a majority of them are from the big theaters, LTC, MTC, Roundabout Theater. And so it's kind of ignorant to say we're just programming the best season for our audiences when you know that's going to have repercussions nationwide. Christopher Durang's play was produced at Lincoln Center, and then it got 28 productions.
But I don't think Lynn's comment wasn't like, we just produced the best plays. I don't think that she sat down and thought, and that our artistic directors, enough of them are thinking, this sends a message. This season as a group of plays. This is like a menu. This is your cabinet. This is your, like, if you lined them up and did a portrait of them, what would that look like? I don't think people are taking the time to say, wow, that's just a bunch of white guys. Wow, I didn't.
Yeah, and those white guys are going to be the ones that get produced around the country. Like, right. They are setting the scene for what the American theater is going to look like next season.
And I think that's why there was more of an outcry about MTC versus International City Theater, because MTC is the leading nonprofit in the field.
Right.
And we need to hold our leaders to higher standards, because they are the ones where the plays do get picked from, unfortunately.
I totally agree. And I think we are all, because we're all part of the nonprofit field, and because TCG and MTC is a member of TCG, as are all the other ones we've mentioned, we are part of the problem, and we are also part of the solution. I don't think we can exile anyone from the, or, you know, vote anyone off the island. We want people to work this out. So I think it's helpful to call each other to account on these things.
No, I also think something interesting. I mean, some people are noticing. I had a conversation with Marsha Norman this morning, and she's been trying to get audience members to send notes about subscriptions when they get subscription flyers, and if they're all men or not diverse, like, just send a note to the subscription team. And after she said that, I was on Twitter, and I saw that Bobby Cannavale tweeted a picture of the Roundabout subscription brochure being like, what is this? Go see Hamilton.
That's good.
Which I thought was, you know, interesting. He took his season brochure and made his voice known.
Yeah, I should just shout out Alexis Solaski, wrote a good editorial in The Guardian about Broadway, but also the nonprofit seasons, and, you know, suggesting ways which they could be made more diverse.
Although I will say, she said there are no plays by women on Broadway this season, and Helen Edmondson wrote the play, Therese Raquin, at Roundabout.
She adapted the Emile Zola novel, yeah.
She adapted a novel, so, I mean, she gets a co-author credit.
Yeah, but the only new young playwright of, I mean, young female playwright is in there. Roundabout is in there.
Yeah, but she said there are no women on Broadway this season, and Helen did write that play.
That's true.
There you go. She's a Brit, though. But
she's still a woman.
British invasion.
I also think her article failed to mention Lila Nuremberger as director of Runes.
Oh, which one?
MTC. She said Penelope was directing and writing Runes.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Oh, well, actually, yeah. Lila Nuggenbauer is not. It's tentatively planned. But yeah. But that's not on Broadway, though, is it?
No, that's off Broadway. I'm just fact checking Alexis here.
Again, it was a disappointing week in many ways, but we are preparing a giant October issue in which gender parity, line between them, is one of the big things. Susie's writing a big piece about it.
Yeah, and I think the piece that's more I think about it that I'm writing about it is interesting, not just because I'm writing about it, but because a lot of people have been giving flack that all this accountability. What was that, Rob?
Rob's eating a couple of noodles right now.
No, just because all of the conversation about gender parity and keeping seasons accountable have been about, like, people who are doing it wrong. It's like, this person's doing it wrong, this person's doing it wrong, this person's doing it wrong. And there hasn't been a lot of positive affirmation of people that have just been doing it right all along. So we're going to try and give that to them.
Yeah. Right, and I think also showing trend lines, and not to be a Pollyanna about it, but they're trend lines, particularly among younger playwrights, I think are more encouraging. I mean, we didn't do this with our stats this year. We did it by the age of the plays. But by the age of, if you look at the age of the playwrights, that's a stat we should look at some point without getting too personal. If you look at playwrights under 50, say, or 45.
Once you figure out how to do it. If right, no one we'll has suggestions on how saying, we can do this you can, in that you can do
it,
fashion.
Just, someone did it last year with our top 10 list. They looked at playwrights under 45 or something.
But it's easier.
It was parody. Yeah.
But then I mean, also, it's easier for like a 10-person list versus a 2,000-person list.
Well, no, of
list,
course.
Which is what we're working with.
I'm just saying. You can do samples and you can get a picture that this general sense that like places like Playwrights Horizon, Signature Theater have been great on parity, great on diversity, and
they've been okay. Let's not give them too much.
They have been they have been great. Playwrights has a very good record.
And for field, the way the field is,
yeah.
I would say they've been great.
I mean, one black playwright within a 2-year period does not make it diverse.
We said parody.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
Well,
you also said
diversity. Gender stuff.
On the gender stuff, yes.
Yeah,
not on the diversity part.
A lot of vectors, yeah, diversity.
I mean, granted, we shouldn't conflate the two things.
Yeah.
And also signatures is different from playwrights, but yeah. But yeah, look, the field has a long way to go.
But I also want to go back to what you said about the age of the playwrights, because that's interesting. Both of my conversations for my article with Lisa McNulty and Marcia Norman, I was talking with Lisa McNulty, and she made the comment that female playwrights reach a certain age and they kind of disappear, and male playwrights reach a certain age and they become masters. And when I was talking to Marcia Norman today, she was like, yeah, I reached a point, I won the Pulitzer, I wrote Night Mother, and then nobody wanted any more plays from me. They were like, you can write another play like Night Mother and we'll see it, but we'll complain that it's just like your other play,
yeah,
and you're writing the same women's play over and over again.
Yeah.
And so she was forced to move into musical theater, and a lot of her, you know, contemporaries kind of disappeared and were wiped off the map. And she was like, yeah, men get encouraged to keep going and women kind of reach their peak and go away.
Yeah, and then also plays by men aren't conflated with each other. Because I read the Wall Street Journal article about Eclipse by Danai Gurira, and a lot of theaters said they didn't want to program that play, even though it had a really good reception at Yale Rep and at Center Theater Group, because it reminded them of Lynn Nodge's Ruined, which is also about three women in Africa, but it's a completely different African country. And so there's a tendency to conflate like works by people of color and by women, whereas no one ever says, oh, we just programmed this living room drama this season. It's completely, and we can't do it another one next season because it's a living room drama. But no one ever says that.
I know. I read that article too. And I will be the first to admit, I love a good living room drama. Better if it's set in New York. I really like those plays. But
but no one says we have too many.
No, true. And no one says
I think people do say we have too many, but they still get programmed.
I enjoy them. I enjoy them, artistic directors.
Yeah.
Lots of people can write them.
Right.
They can
and
come from different voices.
Yeah, but then we can still have like Ruined and Eclipse in the same season. They shouldn't be.
I mean, Ruined could take place in the living room in Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Eclipse kind of like a living room drama, except in Africa. But at the same time, like, no one's programming them within even two seasons of each other.
I mean, Straight White Men is a living room drama. Like,
yeah, but the point is, no one wanted to program Eclipse, but there's plenty of people programming living room dramas.
I think Taylor Max said something really interesting when we published here and we did the Q&A. He was like, I've been trying to get my plays into, you know, mainstream nonprofit theaters my entire life, and then I finally wrote the form of play that they always produce. It finally got produced there.
Yeah, and it's a living room drama.
It's a living room drama.
I mean, granted, with a young, transgendered boy, but it's still living. It's still more typical than his other plays.
I mean,
plays.
I think that goes back to, I think, Isaac Butler's piece about living room dramas. There's something about mainstream theaters that's...
their go-to?
Well, it's a genre that, you know, it's not a new thing, and it doesn't seem to be going away either, that... living room drama is basically a play about which people talk and have a discussion, whether it's Disgraced or Here, or and it does seem like
or Bad Jews
form breaking plays don't make it to certain levels at resident theaters or on Broadway, which I think was one reason. This is going way off topic, but Annie Baker's work is so interesting right now because the scale of the work she's doing, both in time and space, I don't think she's going to go to Broadway with that stuff, but because it's really divisive. But it is pretty fascinating aesthetically what she's doing, and at a pretty high level of production value.
Well, yeah. And Hills and All still makes it about her gender.
That's a whole other discussion we can have.
It's like, what? She's a woman and she can write boundary breaking plays? Oh my God, the surprise!
Yep.
Well, I
and
think
won the Pulitzer for it too.
Hilton Howes is a third rail for me. So let's move on to our next topic. Our interview today is with Mark Valdez, who's the outgoing executive director. I believe that's the title of the Network of Ensemble Theaters, which, as we talked about with Jim, last episode. As sort of a subset, that makes it sound like less than, but there's been a strong counter movement, that's a better word, as the resident theater movement has grown, of smaller ensemble-based companies, Cornerstone being one of them. Mark Valdez comes out of Cornerstone, worked there when he was a younger artist. And it's a group that I think formed in much the way the Latino Theater Commons formed in part. We won't take credit for it at TCG, but it formed in part by the people who were gathering at TCG and realizing, we have a lot of affinity, let's start our own thing. They formed about 10 years ago, give or take, out of TCG. People met at TCG and realized, wait, we have a lot in common, and we have a lot of things to talk about and needs to be met that aren't being, talked about anywhere else. Let's have our own organization. So it's a fascinating interview, which I conducted with him at TCG in Cleveland. Here's my interview with Mark Valdez. So with Mark Valdez,
hi.
You are the executive director of Network Ensemble Theaters. How long have you had that job?
I've been with NET for 8 years.
That predated you, right?
NET predated me. It actually grew out of a TCG. It was originally the TCG Ensembles Work Group.
Right.
It started about 19 years ago.
Okay.
At a TCG conference. And ensemble members from around the country were at a TCG conference. And they started to talk to each other and said, hey, we have this ensemble thing in common.
Right.
We should talk to each other some more. And so they wanted to meet again, and TCG provided some support to bring them together. And then from that became the Network of Ensemble Theaters.
And how big is it now? How many theaters?
We have about 400, wow. 400 members, of which we have about 280 theaters.
Oh, ensembles. Okay. Because others are...
So we have student membership, okay. Individual okay. Memberships, and affiliate memberships.
I see. Individuals as well.
Yeah.
But it's an ensemble
thing, well, right? There's a lot of people who...
are interested in that kind of
work. Who are interested and who just haven't found their ensembles.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
What happens if your ensemble disbands? You're still committed to this kind of work. You just aren't in an ensemble. And so...
But you're an ensemble theater person.
Yeah.
Right. Who was your predecessor? I don't know.
There wasn't one.
Oh, there wasn't
so
one.
I was the first. I was the first executive director. I was the first staff hire for NET. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of weird because NET's been around for a long time, but at the same time, we're an 8-year-old organization.
That would be why I didn't know who you took over because you were
because there wasn't one.
The position was created for you. So let's go back to this idea of ensemble theaters. I think most people think of you mean like Steppenwolf or like, I mean. Companies with acting ensembles, but that's not the whole picture, right?
Correct. I mean, NET defines ensemble as groups of people who work together over a long period of time to develop a unique body of work. And here's the next part, is where artists and administrators have a say in the direction of the organization. And it's that second part that I think distinguishes an ensemble from, say, like an acting company.
Even something that got a little larger, that latter thing would be the key.
Correct.
Because a lot of companies obviously start up with just actors and artists want to put up a show together, and they keep doing it for a while, and then they might institutionalize. But if they don't do that last bit, like you're saying, then they're really not, then they're whatever, they're not an ensemble company anymore, right?
Correct.
Right.
And, and at the same time, we it's a very fluid,
it's fluid.
It's very
sure,
open
sure.
definition,
right.
And we are the last people to say, well, you don't do
right,
this.
Right,
so,
right.
So like, it's really like, if you identify as such, and if this is where you want to spend time thinking about it,
right.
Then welcome.
So now, that's I haven't looked at a full list of them. What would be some of the range of the kinds of companies mm-hmm. that are part of the Network? Does it go to larger
largest companies?
So I think the largest company we have is Looking Glass. Okay. It's probably the largest member. Okay. But also, like, something to keep in mind about the ensemble field is that most of our members have budgets of under 100,000. Yeah. And I would say, like, maybe 70% of our members have budgets of 100,000 or less.
Yeah.
So within the within the ensemble field,
yeah.
if you take out Steppenwolf and Looking Glass,
yeah.
most are operating about $1.5 to 2 million, thereabouts. So you know, the field itself doesn't skew towards $29 million organizations.
Oh yeah, sure. You mean the larger field, the non
of ensembles.
Ensembles, right. Mm-hmm. And so then all the way down to just tiny groups. I mean, now the group I know you from, Cornerstone, would be one ensemble. They would qualify. I don't know if they're members.
Correct. Yeah, they're members. They're founding members. They were one of the first group of people. Yeah.
And I know that. The Latino Theater Commons Theater issue. Yeah, the initiative that came out also came out of a TCG thing from a couple years ago.
Correct.
Right? Uh-huh. So this is a common thing that's come out of TCG conferences. Would you say that there was a feeling over the years that this was an alternative that was needed because TCG wasn't addressing this specifically, or was just?
I think you know, we all have a need for community, right? And there's different ways of thinking about community. So we have this larger community that people want to come to that brings everyone together. And within that, there's always sub-communities of every larger community, and you have the need to have your own conversation.
Right.
So
right.
so I never looked at it so much as like TCG provides or doesn't provide, as much as people have a need to have different types of conversations. And sometimes you want to have a conversation with a particular affinity. Yeah.
No, I mean, it seems like it's a positive spin-off. And TCG can't be all those things all the time to everybody.
Completely.
You know, at the same.
But TCG can make the space where you can find each other.
Be the tent or the big tent or whatever. Whatever metaphor you want to use.
Yes.
So a lot of the issues that come up with ensemble companies and, you know, artists versus administration are kind of like at the heart of what we're always thinking about. As an American Theater Magazine and just anybody who cares about theater and TCG in general, what would you say are the biggest issues, that agenda issues that have animated the discussions with network ensembles? Is it compensation? Is it artistic access? Is it, audience development.
I think it's all of those things. I mean, partly again, it's a difference. You know, when you add the element of scale, the conversations are just very different. So a lot of it has to do with sustainability and compensation. I mean, when you're operating at 100,000 or less, your operating budget is your production budget, right? So that's what it is.
Right.
And so few people are getting paid for it or getting paid so little. But there's a commitment. There's this ongoing commitment. We did a study of our membership. We found that so something like 60% of our members have budgets of $100,000 or less.
Right.
And most of these companies, the median age I think is 15. I think the average is something like 13.
For how old the company is?
Yeah. And so even though many of them are not getting compensated living wage by any stretch, there's still something that keeps them together. They subsist, they sustain.
Right.
And so I found that I think it's an interesting kind of perception that because you're a small company, especially within the funding world, a lot of attention. The small companies are overlooked because of the assumption that they're not going to stick around very long.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
You know, so we can't. There's a sense that there's a high turnover of companies, why invest so heavily? Because, you know, those who are going to stick around will become mid-sized organizations, and then we can fund them at the mid-sized.
Well, there is a lot of pressure to grow, right?
Completely, like what's happening in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's that, definitely. I mean, I wonder, are any of the companies who are working in a 99C plan ensemble?
We have a lot of members in Los Angeles.
And did network ensemble theaters have an official position on that, or did you?
We didn't. Free compensation is one of our values, we're always talking about that need. We also recognize that it's going to look different for every organization, so we have to. You know, we advocate compensation, our funding programs as part of our criteria, as our artists being compensated fairly.
Yeah, yeah.
So something that we advocate, but how, you know, how a 99-seat theater, small, you know, a $50,000 theater defines that.
Right.
It's just naturally going to look different than how a, you know, $30 million organization defines that.
Right.
So we can't come in like, or we've avoided saying this is what it is.
Right.
And you know, we name the value and ask that you consider that and define for yourselves what how you have to name it.
Right.
Define it.
Yeah, and I it was a frustrating conversation. It's still going on, I guess. The debate over the equity 99-seat plan and that scene. I don't know. You're from the Bay Area, is that correct?
No, from
you're from Los Angeles. Originally.
Well, I'm actually from Texas.
That's right. We've talked about this. So, and I'm from Arizona, so Southwest. Yeah. That scene sort of nourished and nurtured me. That's a scene where I got the taste for live theater. And, you know, I discovered that there's a lot of other great theater elsewhere and a lot of bad theater everywhere, too, right, including L.A. But that's – it seemed to me that the model of a lot of companies there, I don't know, it wasn't necessarily sustainable over a long term. But a lot of them found ways to, and I find this is true in a lot of, I find it in New York even also, companies that will get themselves together to put on at least a show a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their model, that they don't expect to make a living doing it. They don't make a living doing it.
Yeah.
They have to beg, borrow, and steal sometimes, or do a Kickstarter, whatever it is. But they are committed to doing one show, at least one show a year. And then there's others, like Debate Society, for instance. They've gone to a level where they're getting commissioned and they're, I imagine they make something like a living doing what they do now. And that's an ensemble. I think of them as an ensemble.
Yeah, yeah, I think they would identify
because
such,
they write the plays, star in the plays.
Yeah.
The director is part of the group.
But even then, like it's interesting because like there's also it also gets us into little territory. So there's just kind of the sustainability part, right?
Right.
We all have day jobs, but we're going to commit to doing one show a year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's also the reality of how many ensembles work, which is it takes them a year just to make a piece
of work. That's true, yeah. Well, that's...
You know, and Debate Society is a wonderful example of, you know...
Well, that's one of the ensemble theater values, too, as well. It's not just because that's all we can afford. It's because we want to spend that much time working, like Ghost Road.
Developing,
working
yeah.
on something for Mm-hmm. And go off and do that. I know one of the models that was talked about in the debate over the 99-seat plan was, could there be some sort of lab theater thing where people can work for as long as they want? And just you basically – and then when it comes into the larger theater where there's rent to pay and there's tickets to sell and they have mm-hmm. marketing, but then the people have developed this great show on their own sweat equity, and then they bring it into – the Rude Mex brings a show to the Kirk Douglas or whatever or to New York. I mean, I don't know if that's a good model either because then people – aren't making money for all that time they put in.
But that's exactly the problem. You know, like right now in this country, there's just so little support for development.
Yeah.
And it happens on the backs of artists mm-hmm. with the hope that you will tour and make that money back.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
you just, like, the finances don't ever work out. Like,
no.
You can't charge enough for tickets to really support that kind of mm-hmm. development time. And so I think for me, it's like, how do we bring more development support for the creation of work, for the process of creating.
Didn't Flint Ridge used to give
Registry
a grant?
Yeah.
They do still? Or
no, they no longer fund the arts.
But they used to, specifically in Southern California, I remember they gave grants for ensembles.
For ensembles, yeah.
Right?
They had an ensemble
Nancy Keystone,
program.
I think, did mm-hmm. it with her devising.
Yeah, no, several. Cornerstone was one, Actors Gang, and there were a lot of...
Did Audrey Skirball probably did something similar to it? I don't know. Maybe they just did plays. I can't remember.
I think
remember
they just did plays, is my memory.
Plays.
Yeah.
And that's maybe another issue about the aesthetics of ensemble that maybe sure. is an issue for you all is creation
yeah.
and this word devised, mm-hmm. whatever that means.
And
ownership also. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm just sort of...
So one of the things that the issues of things that talk
yeah,
that ensembles are trying to figure out is... is the ownership of devised work, of company
yeah,
created
exactly.
work.
Yeah, exactly, right.
So as more and more companies either – there's also a lot of interest in working with playwrights, and so we see more actually net funds a program to bring a playwright in with an ensemble so they can collaborate.
Right.
But there's more interest in that. So the example of well, who owns the work and who gets compensated for what? And as ensembles are touring more, are getting more opportunities to present work
right. –
oftentimes it's not a big deal because it's the company and it's part of their season. They all
right.
agree, like, we're going to create this work, and it doesn't go beyond that initial production.
Yeah, yeah.
But as it starts to tour or as there's subsequent productions of work, issues of compensation are coming up. And so one big thing is that we're trying to figure out, like, how can we develop some templates, some at least guidelines for these conversations to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's increasingly becoming something that ensembles are having to deal with.
I'm wondering, this is an idea that it's not original, but I think pig iron gives me the idea, because mm-hmm. I think I've heard a quote from one of the guys there, maybe Dan, was saying people they've thought about taking the word theater company out of their name.
Yeah.
Because they've got fans who say, we don't like theater, but we like what you do. And it makes me think this whole idea of creating things together and then maybe Kirk Lynn is going to be pulled out of Rudmix as the writer, or mm-hmm. it's like bands.
Or Richard Montoya.
It's like bands, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like rock
the
bands.
The front man, yeah, totally.
The front man gets singled out, and, you know, in many ways he or she is the primary creative voice in a way,
yeah.
right? Or the organizing principle, or the star that people want to hook onto. I wonder, are there models? I mean, this is more anecdotal than knowing what I'm talking about, but I think REM, for instance,
mm-hmm.
U2, some of the bands that have stuck around for as long as they have, it's because they have these fairly equitable, everyone owns everything, we're not going to argue, we're not going to be fighting in court for the rest yeah. of our lives over who owns these giant songs. And so I don't know if you know of models where ensembles say, look, yes, Kirk is going to write the words on the page, but we all own it, or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think we're just not getting into that level of conversation with our
right.
members. I mean, I think for a long time, there were more pressing needs. And
yeah.
I think now that we're kind of at this point where I think ensembles, they're no longer, they're in the center. Like we are, it is like as mainstream. It is smack in the center of the theater field now.
You mean so, ensemble work? Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So now I think we're at the point of really tackling these kinds of questions. So I think there's still a lot, and certainly I think Ned is still trying to get a good sense of what that landscape is. So to answer your question, I don't know many are actually, you know, what the various agreements are, and I think that's part of like in addressing this need is to do that kind of mapping.
Yeah. Okay.
See so what the models are.
The retreat is in the final retreat. Is that what you mainly? Ned does a lot of retreats, don't you?
We do a lot of convenings.
Convenings, that's the word.
Yeah.
Sorry, retreat sounds too kickback. Right?
No, we convene like crazy.
Yeah.
And their work a long time ago, probably like maybe the second year after I was on staff, we said we're all way too busy and there's too much going on that. I don't understand why we would just get together. Total value in it.
Right.
So, you know, I get it. But we've got, there's so much work to do.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That if we're going to come together, then let's come together to work together.
Okay.
Let's come together and, like, pull all of this information and move it towards something.
Right.
So
right.
That's when we started to do the first round of micro festivals. And
okay.
These microfests were looking, like the first round was looking at like how ensembles are creating work. And so we wanted to tackle aesthetics. So we did a convening around what are the aesthetics of diversity,
okay.
You know, all through ensemble.
Right,
prison.
Right, right.
So we did an event in Atlanta and just dug in and instead of trying to do a whole conference with a whole lot of topics. This was like, we're going to focus
just one
on
topic.
This.
Okay, yeah.
But it would inform the next conversation, which was, how are ensembles generating new work?
Okay.
You know, so what is the process and who's in the room and what are those practices and how do you share leadership and how do you create?
Right.
And those two, we did that in Los Angeles, and those two informed the third conversation, which is, well, what do we call this kind of work?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's cross-sector. It doesn't really adhere to a genre. It's
right.
Like maybe it's dance, but does it matter? Like
yeah.
how if we can't talk about it, if we can't name it,
yeah.
then the conversation around it is not going to be particularly useful.
Right, right.
If we can't talk about the intentions behind why we're doing this.
Right.
So all of these connected.
What was the last microfestival? Where was that?
The last one we just did in Hawaii.
Oh, right.
In
okay.
Honolulu. Yeah.
Wow, that's nice.
Yes. So we also go, you know, like we also really try to get across the country to the various places.
Was Honolulu Theater part of that conversation?
Honolulu Theater for Youth?
Yeah.
Because
they seemed like they devised
they're
it
an
together.
Ensemble, they're
yeah,
members.
They
yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been to Honolulu once, but I didn't. It was a family vacation. I didn't have a chance to go. I didn't have a chance to check out their theater. But.
That was part of it. Yeah, everybody goes to Hawaii to vacation,
right.
And there's this whole community there that people would never see because it's so hard to get off Waikiki, and why would you? It's,
right,
it's
sure,
so beautiful.
Sure, sure.
So that was really great.
But Honolulu, they're in the same island though.
Correct, on Oahu.
But there's other communities you're saying even?
There's a whole lot of, and okay. It's interesting. So something that NET's moving towards more and more, you know, you were talking about pig iron getting rid of the word theater.
Yeah.
I think one conversation that we're having is like how we are now cross-disciplinary. There's a lot of dance companies or dance theater companies in NET. We have a visual arts collective, we had a music ensemble, and so the questions are really that we're struggling with, and we've not kind of found an answer, but part of the conversation that we're really engaged in that we want to really engage our members in is like, how do we, are we at a time now to just be much more expansive?
So it should be NET, not NET,
Net.
Right? Network of ensembles, or network of artistic ensembles, how that?
Yeah, I don't, but even the word ensemble becomes problematic once you start to interrogate it.
Okay.
You know, it's a European construct. A lot of people don't quite know what it is.
Sure.
You know, and as you're talking about, oh, what about if you're the individual who's like, I'm just me. Like I'm part of an ensemble, so there must be no room for me here.
Right.
That you know, like where have we constructed barriers that are unnecessary?
Hmm.
And so these are all just conversations we've not kind of answered them. But
so what the last convening is in that you'll be part of is in August. Where?
August in Maine, in Lafayette.
In Maine.
Maine.
That's a great time to go to Maine.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's at this campsite, and it's
wonderful,
fantastic,
and. Why are you leaving? And what are you going to do after that? Mark. You've done, your work is done.
No, the work is never done.
Okay.
I feel like NET has grown, and it is. We've done a lot of really good things. NET is busting at the seams, and it's ready to undertake its next, to kind of enter its next iteration. It's ready to get shedding some skin, and something else is going to emerge. And for me, like I just had this moment of, okay, we're at this transition point, and you either see it through for like the next 4 or 5 years till that gets set, or right now is the time, or right now, like leave now so that somebody can come on and usher the organization through this next transition.
Right.
And so it was just really just that moment that just, you know, you had to ask questions. And I think while I love the organization, I'm missing being spending time in a rehearsal room. I just haven't gotten to do that as much as I've wanted to. And there's a book and some essay projects that I want to get to. And it's just hard, you know, just running an organization is just, it's all consuming.
I was trying to think of, someone said something similar, Jim Simpson at the Flea was, you know, they just raised money for this new space downtown. And he specifically said he would like to step aside so that Nigel Smith can come in and make it his own company, because it's going to be a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of work to redefine the Flea in the future. Is there a successor? Is there going to be a successor?
There will be.
The
organization is actually, it's interesting, is moving to a co-director model. So I think the ultimate goal, I think, as the board is envisioning it, is three co-leaders, or co-eds, as I like to call them.
I'm sure this has been pointed out to you before, that the sort of irony of having a single leader for the ensemble.
Completely,
network.
No, exactly. It's like it's weird. It's totally weird.
But you need somebody. You can't. It's at least more than or fewer than the whole group.
Sure.
And the
reality is, like, I have this executive director title, but the reality of how we actually function is I'm co-leading with my colleague, Alicia Tonsic, who's the managing director.
Right.
And so we don't – we've been operating kind of in this co-leader way, like in day-to-day.
Right.
It just hasn't been named that way. And I think that this was the opportunity for the board to say, well, why don't we create the structure that actually reflects – the people that we represent, how does it reflect the way that we actually work?
Sure.
And how do we, you know, and there's so many conversations around equity.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is also like, it's an example of what equity can look like in a staffing structure, for instance, that it becomes a model of like we all want like more equity and shared and more distribution of power and more distribution of salaries. And so, So like this is like, well, here's a model of what it could look like to like actually implement that in a staff structure, an organizational structure.
But there still has to be some, if the word's not hierarchy, there has to be some sort of job descriptions.
It's ensembles, right? Yeah. Like just because it's ensemble doesn't mean that they don't create.
Director,
exactly.
Right. It's not a designer.
It took the same thing.
Some different skill sets, right. Speaking of, I did want to ask you about, I know I see your name occasionally on season schedules for different projects. Molly's show.
LMIP.
At Mixed Blood, Molly was a colleague of ours at Molly Smith Metzler at American
Theater.
She's
amazing.
She's doing great work.
Fantastic writer.
So I saw that, but I mean, so you've done directing over the years. You still direct.
I have been able to direct.
And you're going
to
do more.
And I want to do more.
Do you have more? Do you have a project you want to tell us about? Or
right now, I'm really excited about a project called DJ Latinidad's Latino Dance Party.
I heard about this. It's Mixed Blood, right?
Mixed Blood.
Yeah.
So we're commissioning 15 different Latino artists, different disciplines, all with the prompt of what is Latinidad in right now, United States 2015.
Right.
And we've got 8 playwrights that have submitted 10 minutes worth of material. What's really interesting that we're seeing the things are coming in. No one is dealing with identity politics.
Right.
Like, okay. It doesn't come up.
Right.
Like,
right.
They're just a bunch of stories. They're all over the map.
Right.
But identity politics just isn't a factor.
Right.
We're seeing no Spanish. Like, they're all written in English.
No Spanglish even?
No, they're all written in English.
Huh.
There's a couple of, like,
a word here and there,
but
yeah,
not
yeah,
enough
yeah.
to call it Spanglish.
Do you think that's a generational change of
Completely.
Writers?
Completely.
Yeah,
I mean, I really think, like it, you know, when the commission started to come in, Jack gives me a call and he says, hey, like, I'm worried that the artists aren't doing the thing that we asked them to do. And I'm like, no, they're doing exactly what we asked them to do. It's just not what we thought they were going to do.
Speaking of, one question I want to ask you, just as you come to the end of this 8 years... what trends you've seen, maybe in the larger field, but specifically in ensemble companies. You've talked a little bit about the way that it's become cross-disciplinary, it's become more mainstream as well, the idea of ensembles. What trends have you seen, you know, in the field?
There is, I mean, I think when I first started my job, a big part of the job was explaining ensemble.
Right.
Like, what is an ensemble? And it really was, I would go and talk to a funder, and I would have to just explain
what it is
and why it's different and how it's different and why it needs to be supported.
Yeah,
I have not had that conversation in at least 4.5 years.
That's great.
Or 5 years.
Like, right.
We don't have that conversation anymore. So the role of ensembles, the place of ensembles in the larger theater field, in its expansiveness of, like, funders and supporters and audiences.
Yeah.
It's just we're at a whole other place right now.
Okay.
Something that I've seen a lot is engagement with community.
Okay.
Like, ensembles are place-based entities
for the
most part.
You mean in communities? They're located in
the neighborhood,
place.
The Debate Society, they're in New York.
Right, okay.
Cornerstone is in Los
LA,
Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, Mondo Bazaar is in New Orleans.
Right.
Theater Simple is in Seattle. Like, they live there, they work there, they pay their taxes there, their kids go to school there.
Yeah.
And so you're not jobbing in, so because you're not jobbing in people, the relationship that they have to place is different, and so you start to see different aesthetics.
Okay.
I promise you, you will not confuse work from Detroit with work from New Orleans, with work from Honolulu, with work from Atlanta. They look different. They feel different. They sound different.
Right.
The aesthetics are different because they're rooted in place.
Wow. Okay.
There's an aesthetic, the relationship between place and aesthetics is more and more, like, apparent, and I think people are starting to own a little bit more.
That's exciting.
That's great. Also, the engagement of community. I think Jerry Stropnicki from Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble and Bogart, actually, I heard her say something very similar, is that you start an ensemble and in those first few years, you're only interested in each other. You're interested in the inquiry that you're all there to figure out.
The people in the room together.
The focus is on the people in the room.
Right.
And that's important because
you
have to establish that family, that connection, that way of, like, how you work what that practice, what that methodology is.
Yeah, yeah.
But once you do that, then you get really interested in those in people who are not in the circle.
Right, right.
And now where the ensemble field is, there's a lot of, we're there. Like, there's a lot of interest in what is outside of our circle.
Right, right.
And a lot of it has to do with community engagement.
Huh.
Not necessarily community-based. That's not necessarily what I mean. But the conversation that the company, that the ensemble is having with their community.
With its audience, the community, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it goes beyond audience development,
right,
but it
right.
really is like, how are we dialoguing? And in some ways, it just starts to inform the material, like
right.
what is being created.
Right.
And so we're in this really exciting place where that's happening.
Cool.
And I would have the... One, I have this writing project for after I leave Met, but one of the from kind of the view that I've had, I think I don't think that we're doing art for art's sake anymore.
Okay.
And I think that period has actually ended a while back.
Okay.
And I think we're somewhere else that has to do, you know, it has to do with usefulness and purpose of art that we haven't had to address before.
Okay.
And it's proof. I serve on a whole lot of grant panels.
Yeah.
Like
I'm
a professional panelist at this point. and all of them, public, private, all of them, you have to explain how this benefits your community.
Right, right.
Like, you can no longer just do art just because you want to do something
right.
beautiful.
Right.
Like
right.
it has to serve a purpose.
Right.
And I think we've, as a field, we haven't had that conversation yet. And I think it's a really conversation, and I think
think people are threatened by the conversation.
Completely.
Because the version of the conversation I know from, the version of that conversation that I've heard is more just about, oh, it has to have a social value. It has to be, you can only get funding for an education project, not for the art. So we have to funnel the money that we get for our teaching programs into the actual stuff we want to do. I mean, it's been those kind of workaround conversations.
Yes.
Rather than, I think it is a really genuinely challenging conversation people should probably think about, is what is this for, right? It's not just for our own sake. I do wonder whether people can still develop an aesthetic, whether they still need at certain phases of their careers or their making of art, whether they need that time in the lab, you know, just making it, and whether that needs to still be supported. But whether that's, I feel like it's true probably that too many companies, or maybe it's a generational, as you say, trend thing, who kind of have believed that they're doing their art for themselves, and that's really the end in itself, and that's all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it kind of, our conversation chases its tail a little bit, because I think, you know, the best art kind of does have its own justification, but that's because it's engaged a community. It's got a community around it because it's so what it is. You know what I'm saying? I don't.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's a false distinction, but it is a real conversation for.
I don't place any judgment on either. Like, I'm not
right.
saying
oh,
one
I
is
got
better
you.
Than
I
the
got
other.
You. Yeah, yeah.
And I actually don't think it's a false distinction.
No.
Because I actually think that there is a distinction that,
right.
that is real. And
or false choice, I guess, maybe. Because it's a distinction that's real, but to say you have to choose one or the other, I guess.
Completely.
Is what I'm
you do
that's
not have
saying.
To choose.
Right.
However, as the professional panelist,
yeah.
it's increasingly harder
yeah.
to finance your work if it isn't,
if
you can't say
yeah, what it's for.
What it's for.
Right, right, right.
And there will always be, like, there will always, and there should be, God, please, let there always be just art for the sake of creating
right.
something that is artistic.
But I'm thinking of the generation of Richard Foreman and Worcester Group and people that are just doing crazy stuff because they want to do it.
Yeah.
But they found an audience and dealt with their audience, and in a way they had their community, I mean, Worcester Group's still going, but they have their community around them. But maybe some of the problems that groups from a aesthetic of that generation might have is when they, in a new world where just give us money to because we're cool, it's not going to work anymore.
It's not
going right?
to work.
I think this may be revisiting what we spoke about before, but the relationship of ensemble companies to the big resident theaters in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
what you were describing about how their aesthetic is different and relates to the community sounds to me a lot like what should be the mission statement of a lot of resident theaters, right?
And it was.
Yeah, it was when it started. I know. Yeah. I wonder the relationship between ensembles and Lort theaters, or not even Lort, just resident theaters. Mm-hmm. Has that been a big conversation? Or is that really, it just sounds like the, it just sounds like to me like the network, the ensemble theaters that you're dealing with aren't so worried about that. They're not like, please let us in the big house, you know?
No, I mean, I think there's, I mean, big houses are attractive.
Well, sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
They're warm and they're comfortable. Some, you know, oftentimes.
Good audiences.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
So, yeah. So I think it's, I think people want and enjoy, when given access to it, I think people enjoy the opportunity that that allows them. I can't think of anybody that is like, oh my God, why won't such and such companies present us, please?
Right, right,
like,
right.
Nobody is like just standing there waiting. But I do think we're finding ourselves like, just economy, aesthetics, art, all these things like this. There's a variety of reasons why we're seeing more and more resident theaters presenting ensembles.
Yeah,
I think a lot of it is an aesthetics thing.
Okay.
That ensembles, they develop an aesthetic.
Right.
You know, like I said, that you will not confuse the work of the Rude Mex with the work of, you know, working narratives in North Carolina.
Right.
Like,
right.
You
right.
Just will. You won't.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what is? Is there really an aesthetic difference between a production of whatever play in one theater versus the
well, that's
play
what I was
in the theater?
I think, yeah, that's the thing people often point out about resident theaters is there's a certain sameness that happens with the programming.
And fine. I mean, like, fine. Like people should be seeing this work. Like, it serves a purpose.
Oh, totally.
You know what I mean?
Oh, totally. And, you know, the audience is... They want to see good people. I want to see good people.
Completely.
I didn't see New York. Like, I want to see that play by Dave Lindsay Baer, please.
Yeah.
And with good, really good actors and... I would also like to see the Rude Mex.
Yes, and so that's what ensembles provide. Okay,
right.
It provides an aesthetic specific, aesthetic defined.
Right, right.
Hopefully, high quality. That is something else that helps round out a season.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, back in the day, I always after seeing so many plays at Actors Gang and ensemble work that was so great and was. You know, not being well compensated and not enough people knew about it. And I would go to the place at the Geffen or the Tabor, not to single out any specific. I think this duplication of effort, like, you know, if you get a lot in your season, why don't you just bring one of Chris Wallace's shows to the Geffen? The audience would love it. I mean, you know, maybe they don't love everything, but anyway, I felt like, and some of that kind of thing started to happen a little bit, and it has happened. The Douglas has done a little bit of that.
Totally. And you see a lot, like South Coast, Mark Masterson's doing some wonderful work there with the studio series with Onwin.
Oh, yeah,
some
really
wonderful work
they
out
used
there.
To bring Culture Class to... Culture Class is a great example of a troupe that has
totally
crossed that bridge.
Completely,
and
they have for a long time.
Yeah.
But you just start to see more and more of that, you know, Actors Louisville.
They have done it for a long time, yeah, with City Company and... Mm-hmm. Pig Iron just went there. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think obviously that's not the be-all and end-all for network ensemble theaters.
No, I mean, I think
for ensemble theaters.
Yeah, I think increasingly, I think even Net, you know, is kind of at that point of we really have been establishing this and they've been looking inward and setting that, and now the curiosity of let's face
world.
Out a little bit more.
Okay. Will you still be part of the network?
I will.
They can't leave it completely, right?
Yeah, but I think it's good that I may not be present immediately after. Just people need space.
And you're still on the TCG board, right?
This is my last. This is it.
So we're not going to see you around New York very much anymore.
No.
No. You got to stop by.
I will definitely do that.
All right, Mark.
Thank you, Ron.
It's great
to
talk
to
you.
This is fun.
It was fun.
And we're back, and we have some recommendations and things to talk about. Deep, what do you have?
Why am I always first? Alrighty then. I haven't
alphabetical.
Been...
alphabetical first name. Go on.
Damn it, Allison's not here this week. She's on vacation. Anyhow, but I've been taking a theater sabbatical for the past 2 weeks, as you do sometimes in this kind of career, so I've been doing a lot of reading. And I came across this op-ed in The Independent by Katie Guest. It's called An All-White Shakespearean Cast. It's Theater of the Absurd. And it's timed to Trevor Nunn's upcoming production of The War of the Roses, which is his abridged five-play Shakespeare history lesson featuring, shocker, an all-white cast, as you people should not be doing in 2015. It's a very tidy takedown of why such a thing in this day and age is not apropos, and why, in actuality, if we're going for historical accuracy when it comes to casting, then everyone should have smallpox on their faces and bad teeth and speak in Elizabethan English, and so historical accuracy is not a good excuse for lack of diversity in historical plays, which I really appreciate because it's something that I've tweeted about many times. So that is my recommendation for this week.
So look this up. It's by Katie.
Yeah, it's an independent column. It's by Katie Guest.
Katie Guest. Susie, what you got?
I am also going to recommend a column about that little show you may have heard of called Hamilton. It's a really interesting column. It's by Michael Shulman, who writes for The New Yorker, and he's a really great writer. I don't think he's done any reviews for them. He's done some online reviews, but he does a lot of Talk of the Town pieces, some reports about theater a lot, and he wrote a piece, I think it's only online, I haven't checked my New Yorker issue, called The Women of Hamilton, and it's basically just an article, him opining about how Lin-Manuel Miranda has been very, he's been innovative in Hamilton in so many ways with the non-traditional casting and with the hip-hop and rap and pop music score sung through, but he also, I don't want to spoil the show for anyone who hasn't seen it, and there's some spoilers in this column, but it's also very focused on the women in Hamilton's life, even though there wasn't a ton about these women in history books, because as we know, history doesn't always record the women's opinion. And there are ways, which I won't spoil for you, but if you read the column, they might be spoiled. So maybe if you don't want them spoiled, don't read it. That he really hands the play to the women, which I thought was interesting. And it kind of reminded me of what Lynn said in our cover story interview, which you can read in this month's American Theater, about how he writes ensemble pieces. So people think that Lynn's going to write a show and be the star of the show. And he's like, I'm not the star of the show is the star. And he says he writes ensemble pieces with all different types of characters for all different types of actors because he fell in love with theater by doing high school plays. And so he wants to create that community on stage, which I thought was interesting and also echoes what Michael Shulman says in his column, The Women of Hamilton in The New Yorker.
Awesome. I have just a few. I did see Annie Baker's new play, John, at the Signature Theater. And I think she's doubled down on the size and scale, basically doing a long play on a large set with very few people and not a lot happening. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful play. It's haunting, literally. I mean, I guess not literally.
Yeah, it's haunting.
It seems to be a little bit about ghosts, and yet it doesn't quite tip its hand that way. There's no spoilers.
Should I break my theater sabbatical?
It's definitely
oh,
seen.
Oh, damn it.
Three and a half hours,
guys.
It's worth it.
I wrote a little piece. My editorial this day, this week, was a little bit about John and about naturalism, because it's interesting. I'll just quickly, two podcast things to recommend. The Subtext podcast in Los Angeles that Brian James Polak does. His interviewee last week was Jennifer Haley. It's a fun, interesting interview. She talks about one of those silent writing retreats she went on with Eric N., which you wrote about. Sounds fascinating. And freeing, and I didn't realize that she's from Texas. She has a slight twang that comes out.
I love Jennifer Haley.
The final one I want to recommend is a podcast series. It's not quite on the level of Serial, but if you've got a hankering for a sort of series of long form podcasts, Karina Longworth has a podcast called You Must Remember This. That's about old Hollywood, and I have avoided most of my life happily avoided much about Charles Manson. But she has a series called Charles Manson's Hollywood, a 10-part series on this podcast, You Must Remember This, which is about a bunch of other Hollywood stuff, too, going back to the silent days up through the pretty much the whole century of American film is what she calls it. This Charles Manson series is amazing, and I think the podcast format is a great way to tell the story because you can do a little sound, you can do some music, music was a big part of the story. Anyway, I highly recommend that. And it sounds like I'll be listening to her Karina Longworth's podcast about a lot of things in the future. So I think that's our show this week. Anybody else anything to add?
No, I'll second the John recommendation. I liked it.
John.
Yeah. I'll second the Women of Hamilton only because
I will throw
I don't
them.
Cry in the theater very often. But
don't
then
spoil
Philip,
it.
But then Philippa Sue at the end, I don't know. Hey, I'll tell you what she's doing. She's just singing. And then she cries. And then I cry. And it's such a magical
moment.
If
you don't cry in the last moments of Hamilton, have your pulse checked or have your humanity checked.
I didn't cry, but I still like the column.
If you can't get in, next time we'll talk about how can you get into Hamilton when it costs so much. All right, thanks for listening.
We're the Hamilton podcast.
Right.
Bye.